This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Ugly Feelings, a reading and book launch featuring writers Jack Halberstam, Wayne Kestenbaum, and Maggie Nelson in celebration of their new books. It took place on October 2nd, 2011.
Welcome, everyone. I'm so glad that I just made it, that you guys all made it. And I'm not going to say very much in introduction. Basically, the backstory here is just that I was very thrilled when my very good and very brilliant friends, Jack and Wayne, when I got news that each had a book coming out around the same time that I had my book, The Art of Cruelty, coming out. Not only were they coming out temporarily around the same time, but I was also thrilled when I realized that each of our books circulated around a difficult, perhaps you might say, even a negative phenomenon. So mine, Cruelty, Wayne's Humiliation, and Jack's Failure. So now you know what you're in for. I love doing this event because the books, I think, they're really different from each other in style and in form and in tone. But I think they're also remarkable crossovers, both in terms of the different cultural and political subject matters and also just a swirl of related obsessions. So I imagine and hope that both of those crossovers and distinctions will all come apparent tonight in interesting ways. So as you've probably noticed, all the books are for sale in the back, courtesy of Mobile Libris, so please take advantage of the moment and get them signed by their authors. I doubt that Jack and Wayne need very much introduction to you all. They're very formidable and prolific and important and charismatic and dear and delightful. So I'll just say a few words about each, and then we'll go Wayne, myself, and then Jack, and then we'll return to partying. Although we have this nice table, which it just looks like we should sit down and answer any burning questions after the reading's edited. It just looks that way, so maybe if there are any, we'll do that. So Wayne will read first. Humiliation came out in August. It's Wayne's 13th book. A French translation will be published by Flammarion in 2012. Also in 2012, he'll be publishing The Anatomy of Harpo Marx from UC Press, and a new collection of poems called Blue Stranger with Mosaic Background from Turtle Point. Wayne is a distinguished professor of English at CUNY Grad Center and a visiting professor of painting at the Yale School of Art. Jack Halberstam is professor of English, Gender Studies, American Studies, and Ethnicity at USC. The Queer Art of Failure is Jack's fourth book, and yet another, titled Gaga Feminism, will be coming out next summer from Beacon. It sounds like I'm guessing that there might need to be a second book party next summer for all these new books. And about my own, The Art of Cruelty, I'll just say that it came out from Norton this past summer, and it's my eighth book, but it's the first of my books that I would call cultural criticism, so it was new for me, and I currently live in Los Angeles. And with no further ado, please welcome Wayne Kestenbaum.
So first, just welcome back. Welcome here, Maggie, and welcome back, because it's so great. I just met Jack for the first time tonight, and it's, I think, love at first sight. But Maggie is very dear to many of us here. So I'm going to read just little fragments from my book. And that's it. Humiliation. My primal scene of spying on someone else's surrender was watching Richard M. Nixon resign the presidency on TV. I remember my glee and shock at seeing the physically and morally unappealing head of the country give up his power. Maybe I took the resignation personally because of Nixon's 5 o'clock shadow, which reminded me of my father's face. Nixon resigning, the commander-in-chief humiliated, seemed a quintessential father-brought-low moment. I might have pitied Nixon or pitied the man with the 5 o'clock shadow, but I also relished his punishment, his shame. This chapter, by the way, is called 5 o'clock shadow. This complicated surge, feeling horrified that the powerful man should lose his eminence, but also feeling gleeful that he must display his downfall, lives in me still as a queasy avidity connected with a man's beard, or the seeming incongruity of a shave-worthy man exposed to public shunning. Shun the man who shaves. Humiliate the hirsute. That was my clarion call, rousing me to excitement, but also to remorse and grief. Richard Nixon resigning mentions his body and mentions the horror that fills a body when it stands on the threshold of humiliation and knows it must dive into the vortex. Nixon says, "I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body." Odd that the president should mention his body. Watergate wasn't a sexual scandal, but it manifested as physical abhorrence. Quote, "Therefore I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow." The defeated man dictates his own execution. Noon, high noon, becomes a punishment word, a slated, destined termination. Watching this speech again, more than 30 years later, I still imagine that I am his daughter, Tricia, listening with pride and horror. Skipping ahead, later in the same chapter. And now, since I've mentioned that Eliot Spitzer's head looks to me like a penis, at least when he resigns his office as governor of New York for sleeping with a high-priced escort, I want to add to this book's litany of humiliations, all stacked up for the purpose of showing humiliation's universality and showing that humiliation can metamorphose if the sensation of hitting the bottom is fully experienced into redemption. I want to add some details about my own penis and its proclivities. Politics is not my turf, nor is TV, nor is jurisprudence or history. My turf is my body, an encyclopedia of wishes I can't help but incarnate and whose index lies between my legs. Before I aim my argument in that direction, let me offer a general word about redemption. And I'm going to skip the word about redemption. Penises have two tendencies. They rise and they fall. First, I'll discuss the rise. Mine rises often, too often, especially when it should, for decency's sake, stay down. I became aware of unwanted arousal at an early age, 5, 6, or 7, when a bully made me take off my pants and run across his backyard. Coincidentally, whenever my pants came down, my dick stuck out. The bully asked, "Why is your penis big?" I answered, "It's only big when I pull down my pants." And I thought, I can't wait until puberty when boys compare endowments. Through scuttlebutt, I discovered that adolescent boys size up cocks in locker rooms. Maybe I'd heard about circle jerks, too. In any case, I was not humiliated by my tumescence when the bully pointed it out. Instead, I was humiliated by racing across his backyard naked. As perverse reward for the race, I begged him to show me his mother's college graduation photo. I'd seen it before and wanted to see it again. His mother, now a fat drunk, had once been a beauty who'd studied psychology at UC Berkeley. And so I endured the humiliating and arousing experience of stripping for the bully to receive as payment the pleasure of seeing the magical photo of his mother before her descent into drink. Somewhere there's a little piece of paper. I'm going to just move. The book covers a lot of stuff, for like Simone Weil and Susan Sontag's corpse photographed by Annie Leibovitz and lynching photographs and the Holocaust and major, major stuff. But it's a short evening, and I'm going to just move way ahead into a little more anecdotal terrain. I've tried repeatedly to write about the experience I consider the model for all humiliations I've seen or endured. This scene, my own version of a child is being beaten, dominates my imagination with an obscure power, a combination of horror and fascination that I can never adequately put to rest. My language becomes anesthetized, as if reflecting a mind going numb, whenever I try to write about this scene, which I sometimes call, for shorthand, Kid with His Pants Pulled Down in Third Grade. When I was in third grade, my teacher punished a student, a boy named Bobby, by forcing him to pull his pants down in front of the class. She paddled his naked rear end with a paddle that always hung in a warning position near the drinking fountain. I don't know whether corporal punishment was legal in California or whether this teacher was playing by her own rules. I know that I was afraid of her. The scene frightened and fascinated me for numberless reasons. One, we could see the punished boy's penis. Two, he had pimples, boils, on his buttocks. Three, he was crying. Tears seemed as humiliating as nudity. Four, I was afraid that I would be the teacher's next victim. Five, the punished boy was not a good student. Therefore, I deduced that culpable academic performance led inexorably to genital exposure and buttock redness. Six, the punished boy came from a bad, wrong side of the tracks family, a dynasty of delinquents. Seen from my milquetoast point of view, his tough brothers had criminal tendencies. I still haven't conveyed or exercised the scene's power. Though the boy was ostensibly the humiliated party, the teacher herself seemed humiliated as well, because she had foregone the dignity of her calling. She had involved herself in the boy's penis by exposing it. She had dragged the class into a turgid, low zone that I associate with fetid air, tuberculosis, mumps, nuclear fallout, soot, and a bouquet of other undesirables. It's possible, too, that I wanted to see the boy punished. It's possible that I felt relieved not to be the punished one. It's possible that I was riveted by the sight of his penis or his buttocks. My female classmates, too, could see his penis. Being seen by girls seemed humiliating because, in my askew Weltanschauung, girls were not supposed to be aware of penises. And I imagined that if a boy could not keep his privates hidden, he had lost everything that made him potentially lovable. If a boy was not entitled to keep his dick away from view, then he had been dragged down to the level of a dog. When I reconstruct this incident, I see his genitals from the point of view of the Mormon girl, who was an excellent student, but whom I accidentally hit over the head the year before with a plastic chair. This Mormon girl, I hypothesized, would be especially shocked and shamed by the sight of the delinquent kid's penis. The scene tore my thinking mind into parts. Last paragraph, the pimples on the punished boy's buttocks. I might be conflating two pairs of buttocks I saw that year. I might be confusing Bobby's butt pimples with the butt pimples of Randy, who lived at the far end of my block. Once, playing at his house, I suggested that he pull down his pants. In the bathroom, he complied. I was shocked to discover that his butt was pimply. Shortly before or after that episode, his mother died. Therefore, I firmly associate pimples on a boy's butt with death of a boy's mother. Next door to Randy of the pimpled ass lived a girl named Ann Taylor. Her last name, Taylor, amused me because it seemed embarrassingly similar to toilet. Ann Toilet, I thought to myself, chuckling. How could she survive the shame of bearing such a name? Thank you. Here's Maggie.
More. I want to hear more. All right, well, while Wayne was reading, I just was awash with thinking of parts of my book I could read about penises and pimples and all kinds of things that are weirdly, you know, weirdly in here as a lot of crossover. So now I'm trying to decide if I'm going to read the meat part or the face part to you guys. If I should keep going on the theme or shift gears. So this book is called The Art of Cruelty, and I don't know, maybe I'll take Wayne's advice or example and not introduce too much, but it's kind of just takes, it's mostly about art, but it's also about, you know, very, very similar to Wayne's insofar as, you know, it hits on whether it's the role of women at Abu Ghraib or, you know, the war on terror, or, you know, kind of moves between that and a lot of very specific pieces of art and makes connections between them. So I guess I will read, let's see. All right, I'll read the situation of meat and part of this chapter to just kind of snowball onto Wayne's, what he started here. All right, so the chapter previous has been called Who We Are and is very concerned with questions that people pose about, you know, who are humans essentially? Are we essentially evil? Are we essentially good? Are we essentially, you know, compassionate at heart? Are we essentially, you know, evil? So this chapter's first sentence takes up where that chapter left off. So it's called A Situation of Meat. If at the very least we can call ourselves human, we must concede that humans evidence an ongoing interest in becoming, at certain times and in certain contexts, things, as much as in turning other people into things. The specter of our eventual becoming object, of our live flesh one day turning into dead meat, is a shadow that accompanies us throughout our lives. Of course, for some, this shadow is thicker than it is for others. Certainly, it was very thick for painter Francis Bacon. Every time I go into a butcher's shop, I'm surprised it's not me hanging there, Bacon once said. It was also thick for Simone Weil, which makes her critique in the Iliad or the Poem of Force complicated. Weil's protest depends on her horror at force's capacity to turn human beings into things, either dead things, corpses made by force that kills, or things with souls, i.e. shells of humans, made by force that does not kill, i.e. force that does not kill just yet, which she calls a compromise between a man and a corpse. Yet Weil's theological ruminations are saturated with the desire to dispense with subjectivity altogether and to become completely emptied out, effaced, thing-like, in order to get closer to God. Once we have understood that we are nothing, the object of all our efforts is to become nothing. May God grant me to become nothing, Weil wrote. My meat is only to do the will of him that sent me. When viewed through the lens of Christian theology, this complexity holds no paradox. For in Christianity, the crucifixion and resurrection of Christ, alchemize an otherwise brutal situation of meat into a scene of divine redemption, and not just for Christ, but also for us if we become his followers. As Weil summarizes in Gravity and Grace, the false God changes suffering into violence. The true God changes violence into suffering. This is one of Christianity's most gripping promises, that violence need not remain simply violence, that it can be changed via faith into suffering, which, due to Christ's sacrifice on the cross, is never in vain. The crucifixions of Francis Bacon stand in direct opposition to the above narrative. As John Russell has pointed out, Bacon's crucifixions differ substantively from those of religious paintings, in that Bacon had no designs on painting the crucifixion. Rather, he wanted to paint a crucifixion, which for Bacon is simply, quote, a generic name for an environment in which bodily harm is done to one or more persons and one or more other persons gather to watch, end quote. I know for religious people, Bacon explains, for Christians, the crucifixion has a totally different significance. But for me, as a non-believer, he says, it was just another act of man's behavior, just a way of behaving toward another. In short, if you remove the story of the Passion, if you remove the radiant, suffering face and body of Jesus, if you remove the specter of a miraculous resurrection, you are left with an act of bald cruelty, a situation of meat, and some aggregate of its victims, perpetrators, witnesses, and accomplices. In short, what looks like meaningful divine suffering to one person often looks like brutal, preventable violence to another. religious convictions do not insulate against this divide. In fact, many would say they cause it. To take a particularly garish example, think of Mel Gibson's ludicrous bloodbath of a film, The Passion of the Christ, which focuses 100 of its 126 minutes on the torture, mutilation, and death of Christ's body. I wanted the violence to be shocking, Gibson explained to Diane Sawyer. I wanted it to be extreme so the viewers could see the enormity of his sacrifice. Most critics remained unconvinced, if not downright horrified, by this logic, which claims the shock and awe of surround sound ultraviolence as a worthwhile tool for bringing young people, including young children, to Christian faith. Many churches, on the other hand, knocked themselves out to support the film, offering everything from free tickets to discussion groups to private theater rentals to ensure its wide circulation, believing that, quote, the film presents a very unique opportunity to share Christianity in a way today's public can identify with, end quote, as a certain Reverend John Tanner of Alabama explained. One of the most wicked satires of this logic can be found in Kafka's exceptionally grim 1914 story In the Penal Colony. In this story, Kafka's officer, the operator of a torture execution device called the Harrow, waxes rhapsodic about the glory days in the colony when public torture and execution were a popular spectacle. This is from the In the Penal Colony, quote, "It was impossible to grant all the requests people made to be allowed to watch from up close. The commandant in his wisdom arranged that naturally the children should be taken before all of the rest. I was always allowed to stand close by because of my official position. Often I crouched down with two small children in my arms, one on my right, one on my left, and how we all took in the expression of transfiguration on the martyred face together, how we all held our cheeks in the glow of this justice, finally attained. Oh, what times we had, my friend," end quote. The surrounding story, as we shall later see, eviscerates the officer's interpretation of this execution, primarily by juxtaposing such monologues against the patently revolting situation of meat at hand, a situation epitomized, perhaps, by the recurring appearance of the felt gag the prisoner dying in the Harrow must wear, a gag that is saturated with the vomit of all of those who have been previously executed in the machine. Sorry, this chapter is just going to get worse, I think. I'm just noticing by looking ahead a little bit. All right. Bacon's Three Studies for a Crucifixion and Crucifixion offer scenes of similarly revolting, though perhaps unintentional, satire. In both paintings, the crucified figure resembles a split animal as much as or more than a human and appears upside down, a worm crawling down the cross, as Bacon once put it, rather than a child of God getting ready to make his ascent. An upside-down cross is, of course, a coarse symbol of blasphemy. The witnesses in these paintings are decidedly modern. No weeping or cradling of the meat here, just a woman who looks like she's passing by a bad traffic accident, two men who could be casually checking in on a brutalized detainee in their custody, and two men in fedoras who appear to be eating at a lunch counter, completely oblivious to the bloody action beside them. And then, of course, at the apex of the triangle, there's us, looking at the meat, and looking at the people looking or not looking. By now, a familiar architecture. It is true that Bacon's subject is not consciousness, nor is it empathy, at least not the kind of empathy that depends on consciousness. Bacon's crucifixions do not ask us to empathize. The victims offer up no faces shining with tortured beatitude for our spiritual contemplation. Instead, we get a central panel of a faceless, splayed, pink carcass, its front two limbs taped down to the crucifying plane with unforgiving bandages. And yet, in looking at this painting, a fierce kind of empathy can arise. It is not the kind of empathy that stays on pause until we feel we've understood the being that this meat belongs to or once belonged to. We aren't waiting around to behold the same emotions we have felt reflected back to us in its eminently human face. In fact, in Bacon's crucifixions, the onlookers typically have the more well-defined human faces, yet they seem somehow more horrific than the disasters of flesh and blood in the room with them. He makes no attempt to shock us into feeling, quote, the enormity of the sacrifice, end quote. There is no sacrifice. We do not have to understand or get to know Bacon's figures to feel their pain, nor do they need to represent the pitifully massacred children of God. They are animals on their way down, as are we. That's enough. The figures that dominate Sylvia Plath's late poetry, on the other hand, are almost always on the rise. but as with the spirit of Lady Lazarus, who notoriously rises out of the ash in the poem's final lines to eat men like air, their ascent is usually not very nice. Plus, resurrected figures have an eerily similar effect to that of Bacon's worms crawling down the crosses. They disallow the reassurances of martyrdom, rebirth, and resurrection just as brutally. But in doing so, they also reveal something else, the cruelties and complexities of resurrection itself, and its ties to potentially lethal forms of psychological or historical amnesia. In getting there, for example, Plath's speaker, who's stranded somewhere between an unborn fetus and a wartime prisoner on a train bound for slaughter, is struggling to get there, to rise from Adam's side, to fly to a name, to two eyes, to arrive at a destination she describes as a blood spot, the face at the end of the flare. She does get there, or somewhere, eventually. The last lines of the poem read, "An eye stepping from the skin of old bandages, boredoms, old faces, step to you from the black carved Lethe, pure as a baby." This is very bad, but one gets the sense that for this born again, and perhaps for us in greeting it, the worst is only yet to come. Elsewhere, Plath's ascensions are of a more metaphysical variety, as in, "I think I'm going up, I think I may rise, the beads of hot metal fly, and I love I, am a pure acetylene virgin, attended by roses, by kisses, by cherubim, by whatever these pink things mean." In reference to this ascent, one grumpy critic wrote, "This is bogus spirituality, and it has its admirers, who even seem pleased that Plath could not survive it." But I think it fairly clear from Plath's sarcastic tone, as in whatever these pink things mean, that she means to tinge such a sense with the bogus, precisely to undercut any facile rebirth or purity associated with them. I, for one, am not particularly pleased Plath did not live a long life, but I am pleased that in the short life she did, she managed to produce a poetry that relentlessly exposes the dangers of hoping against hope to step from amnesia into an infantile purity. Many see the confrontation with the body made meat as dramatized in splatter films as fundamental to their psychological appeal. The idea being that such films provide an entertaining, over-the-top place to encounter our primal fears about the worst possible fates of our mortal coils. Surely it's no accident that a slaughterhouse occupies a central place in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, nor that many horror movies feature meat in their titles like Dead Meat, The Midnight Meat Train, Meat Grinder, and so on. Think, for example, of 2009 sci-fi horror extravaganza, District 9, which meshes a futuristic plot with the relentless, gritty obsessiveness with meat, including cannibalistic feeding frenzies, aliens obsessed with cat food, a spectacle of man flesh becoming alien flesh, egregious organ harvesting, and more. Pornographic films are also often called meat movies, not on account of any dead meat per se, but on account of their insistent, intense focus on particularly body parts, i.e. the parts involved in fucking, a focus that can have the effect of parsing the body into isolated chunks of meat, stripped of human subjectivity. At times, the rhetoric between the two genres meets up, as in the term fresh meat vixen, a term sometimes used to refer to the female stars of horror films. As the infamous 1978 cover of Hustler magazine made clear, straight pornography has a long and fraught history of making meat of women. That cover, as you probably all can recall, features a woman being fed into a meat grinder, her legs sticking out the top, alongside a quotation by Larry Flint, which reads, "We will no longer hang women up like pieces of meat," implying one can only suppose that from now on Hustler will be grinding them. The meat-making aspect of pornography is regularly denounced by certain feminists and moralists as woman-hating, soul-sucking, and home-wrecking. At least for straight folks, the souls and homes of queers are presumably too damned to merit much concern. Books such as Carol Adams' The Sexual Politics of Meat and The Pornography of Meat take the argument further in an effort to link up realms of sexual, economic, and ecological injustice. The advent of internet porn has only hastened the charges, in that the internet has made porn not only ubiquitous, but also predatory. It tracks you down about as much as you track it down, and even the most vanilla user is only ever about three clicks away from seeing a 10-year-old giving someone a blowjob or a woman being penetrated by a horse. And don't forget to watch out for those decoys from perverted justice. All right, that's a warning that refers to something earlier. Be all this as it may, but we miss something crucial about the meat-making of porn if we focus only on its most addictive, alienating, and misogynistic aspects. For ecstasy, as we are constantly being reminded, literally means being beside oneself, which means standing slightly apart from one's body and slightly apart from one's mind. from which vantage point one might experience one's body and perhaps one's consciousness as things. The transcendent parts of this smash-up are not typically captured on film. It is likely they are not capturable. Pornography leaves us instead with the spectacle of the meat. Using camera work that can have more in common with laparoscopic surgery than with cinema, hardcore porn knocks itself out to get supernaturally close to the body's capacities for contact and penetration. The closer you go, the more abstract it gets, and the more abstract it gets, the deeper the mystery of why it works, why watching intense close-ups of throbbing pink body parts moving in and out and around each other instantly turns most of us on. That is porn's greatest strength, Virginie Despentes observes. It is its mystical dimension. Of course, not all thingness is created equal, and one has to live enough of one's life not as a thing to know the difference. This may explain why the meat-making of gay male porn doesn't produce the same species of anxiety as that of straight porn, since men, or white men at any rate, don't have the same historical relationship to objectification, and so their meat-making doesn't immediately threaten to come off as a cruel redundancy. Even a literary masterpiece of masochism, such as Story of O, depends on the subjectivity of its protagonist to stay vital. The novel's compelling all the way through, O's self-aware transformation into a thing, but once she asks Sir Stephen for death and she is extinguished, the tension goes slack. The dream, as it were, has died. The Marquis de Sade solved this problem by allowing himself an endless supply of victims to be corrupted, frigged, tortured, and killed, but in doing so, he tipped his writing into comedy. He also tipped it into tedium. One of the most fascinating things about Sade's writing is its immense capacity to shock and its equal capacity to bore. Such a coexistence is typical of pornography, but the sheer volume of Sade's work, combined with his habit of inserting 50-page diatribes about French politics into the middle of an orgy, gives this coexistence a whole new meaning. But perhaps the most profound tedium in Sade lies not in his penchant for voluminous or digressive discourse, but in his preference for meat over flesh. As Angela Carter puts it in The Sadean Woman, it is a mistake to think that the substance of which Sade's actors are made is flesh. There is nothing alive about them. Sade is actually a great Puritan and will disinfect of sensuality anything he can lay his hands on. Therefore, he writes about sexual relations in terms of butchery and in terms of meat. Sade's penchant for meat, like Bacon's, stems in part from his intense atheism. Sade is wholly against transubstantiation. In its place, you will find mechanistically executed penetration, cannibalism, coprophagia, and the like. The meatifying aspect of Sade differentiates him, too, from many other transgressive pornographers, including Georges Bataille, whose blasphemy is always suffused by a mystical interest in the flesh made sacred, as in the ritualistic sex murders of clergy in Story of the Eye. As Sontag puts it, Bataille links pain to sacrifice and sacrifice to exaltation, a view which could not be more alien to a modern sensibility, which regards suffering as something that is a mistake or an accident or a crime. Let's see. This meatifying aspect of Sade also differentiates himself from the Viennese actionists, who regularly argued that certain forms of killing, such as Nietzsche's slaughter of three bulls during the six-day play, or Otto Muhl's penchant for decapitating geese, as in O Sensibility 1970, in which Muhl puts the goose's neck stump to sexual use, are transformed or made sacred by their employment in ritual. As Otto Muhl said of O Sensibility, I became Jupiter. The goose became the symbol of woman. I became the priest who would not kill it in order to devour it, but rather to carry out a kind of magic ritual with it. This is still Muhl. I do not condone animal murders. I show the sentimentality and hypocrisy. With tears in their eyes, they gobble up their geese. Actionism is provocation and performance. It is the representation of moral double standards. Though my aversion to killing animals for art is likely not going anywhere fast, a meat-making instance that holds more interest for me than Muhl's arrives in the infamous chicken-fucking scene of John Waters' Pink Flamingos, during which Crackers, Danny Mills, crushes a live chicken to death between his body and Cookie Mueller's during an unnerving sexual encounter. Mueller recalls in her terrific memoir walking through water in a pool painted black. Even without their heads, they were a lively, nasty bunch of fowl flopping and kicking with all their might. I was getting hurt for real. I had underestimated those chickens, even while I was feeling sorry for them. In the years since filming Pink Flamingos, Waters has not exactly appeased any of his critics with his oft-repeated Warholian reasoning that, quote, we made that chicken's life better. It got in a movie, it got fucked, and it got famous. End quote. But at least this defense makes sport of the projection taking place. We all know the chicken didn't care about getting fucked and famous, and we all know Waters knows it too. Rather than remaining seduced, as is Otto Mule, by his projection that a magic ritual has taken place in which the male became Jupiter and the goose became the symbol of woman. As for Waters, when asked in 2001 whether he had ever felt the need to pull back from any of his provocations, he said, "Well, would I today kill an animal in a movie? Probably not. But I mean, we ate them. We didn't have craft services or anything, and on Pink Flamingos, you had to go find something in the woods. You had to kill it, and you had to eat it. There was no lunch or anything." Cookie Mueller concurs. Later on, after we finished for the day with the sun sinking, this is Cookie, after we finished for the day with the sun sinking beyond the horizon of winter's leafless trees, we roasted all those chickens, and we had a big feast for the cast and crew. Those chickens I'd felt so sorry for earlier sure were delicious. Meat recurs throughout Pink Flamingos, often in hilarious ways. Who can forget the close-up shot of Raymond Marble's genitals when he flashes a woman in a public park, revealing not just his penis, but also a gnarled piece of sausage tied to it. The twinning of the meats, along with the pathos and the uncomfortable-looking twine affixing them, happily renders the penis meat-bound, deflated, a leftover among leftovers. Waters is just as perverse as Sod or the Actionists, but his perversity joyously extends to realms of sexuality in which the phallus is regularly downgraded to penis, a situation of meat characterized by bathos, comedy, and possibility. I think I'll stop there, so thank you.
Okay, the deflated penis is perfect as a entree to failure. Okay, great. Well, this is a great event. Thank you all for coming. I'm delighted to be here with my co-ugly feelings people. And there really is a lot of resonance between the three books. From there's not a lot of penises in mine, I have to say. There is a penis at the end, coming up at the end. So stay tuned. We will get there. But masochism, we're really in the terrain of the negative. So what I want to do in my time, with the help of a few slides, is just tell you why we want to think about failure now, and then I'll tell you how to fail. I think you know how. I'm just guessing. I know I do. But I'll give you the I have like 10, 15, 20 rules of failure, and I'm just going to give you probably five of them, or however many we have time for. If you're wondering about the queer part of the equation, we need look no further than Quentin Crisp. If at first you don't succeed, failure may be your style. And I absolutely love that idea of queerness as the fashioning of a lifestyle out of the scraps that everybody else has rejected. Okay, and he does it so beautifully. I don't know if I have any. Oh, no, I don't. Okay. So, now we can't go back. Hold on. This is a problem with this. Wait. There we go. Okay. We live in an age where, like it or not, you're going to have to get used to failure, right? We live in an age of unprecedented economic collapse. We live at a time when capitalism has told us that the only game in town is winning, and we're now on the absolute other side of economic collapse, and therefore this is the perfect time both to be thinking about failure, but also to be thinking about failure as a critique of capital. And that's one of the big arguments that I make in the book. In a society where success is wholly sort of associated with profit, then failure offers a critique of capital. And I try to bring the critique of capital and the failure together in certain ways. We've lived at a time when capitalism pretended that it was only about winning. It was like, you know, you're going to go to the casino And every time you roll the dice, you're only going to win. Every time you buy a house, you're only going to profit. And of course, in capitalism, there must be winners and losers. And it's that other part of the story that we now have to reckon with. And so I'm deeply interested in losing as potentially the basis for a new form of politics, the kind of politics that we see being acted out across Europe in riots, and the kind of politics that I would loosely call anarchist, that's interested in the failure of these big systems and in building something small out of the wreckage. And I'll get to smallness in a moment. Okay, and there are so many things to say about collapse, ruin, and riots in the wake of the failure of global capitalism, but we are living in the wake of global capitalism, and so we want to know what this terrain of failure looks like. And I do recommend this book. It's a great little book by a collective called The Invisible Committee called The Coming Insurrection, and they give us all kinds of ideas about how to fail better, how to fail together, how to find each other, and in finding each other, push the system further into its collapse, right? So instead of trying to recover, we should be pushing the system completely down into total and complete failure. So they say it's not that the economy is in crisis, the economy is the crisis, okay? And we should intensify that crisis and then make something out of it. Now, in the course of writing, and I just wanted to sort of set that up as a sort of topical issue, because why are we thinking about negative feelings and ugly feelings in this particular moment? And I think it does have a lot to do with this political and economic climate that we inhabit. Now, over the course of writing the book, over the course of writing the book, people have sometimes misunderstood me to be saying that people need to learn how to fail, and then they want tips. They want me to tell them how to fail. So consider this your crash course in failure, and a little self-help guide to failing well, failing better, and five steps to becoming a complete and utter loser in a world where losing now is kind of the right side of history to be on. And so the first rule of failing and losing is well illustrated by a series by Tracy Moffat. So the first rule is learn to lose. Learn to lose. This is something that capitalism has sort of ignored, the fact that in order for there to be winners, there must be losers. And I find a great record of losing in this beautiful photo series that Tracy Moffat did for the 2000 Olympic Games. So when the Olympic Games were in Sydney, they asked her to be an official photographer for the Olympic Games, and I think they thought that as an Aboriginal person, she would, you know, make much of the participation of some Aboriginal athletes in the Games and so on. But what she actually selected to do was to make a record of losing, which, after all, is what sports is. In the U.S., we focus on winning. But in order for there to be winners in sports, there must be losers. And often the drama of losing is much more interesting than the drama of winning. And so in this country, when we watch the Olympics, we know already if an event is being shown at prime time that an American won it, right? So you take all the drama out of it. And this is where the drama comes back. Right, so the happy winners are, it's a boring film. It's a boring aesthetic. The drama of losing, however, is deep and anguished and really, really amazing that she captures it. So she decided, at first she was going to take pictures of the runners-up. And then she decided, no, the runner-up is still kind of a winner. So then she thought the bronze medal, that would be the first loser in a way. And then she thought, no, because these are the people who enter into recorded history. She went for fourth, okay, because that person stands outside now of recorded history. Despite being the number four athlete in the world, they are a loser, right? So that gives us a sense about this zero-sum game that we play of winning and losing that one would want to disrupt. As an Aboriginal artist, fourth actually also obviously references the fourth world and takes us to a larger context of colonialism in which there are only one set of winners and everyone else has to be occupied with the position of loser. Okay, second rule. So now you're going to learn how to be a loser, learn to appreciate losing, see the drama in losing, the narrative of losing. Lesson number two, though, be a lesbian. Okay. So, whoops. All right, yeah. So the idea is to go for other L words, okay? So we had the loser, and you know at the beginning of the L word, if you can vaguely remember that show, it was like all the things that L stood for, and it was lovely, and it was life, and it was longevity, and of course we can make another catalog of L's that's like lack and loss and losing and lesbian, okay? And rather than rescue lesbians in the way that the L word wants to from the category of the loser or the failure, again, I want to push her right back into that category and keep her there, okay? Now, if you don't think that the lesbian is a category of losing, think about the way in which the lesbian basically constitutes a roadblock to capital. So we live in a culture where anything can be commodified, we've been told. Anything can be co-opted. You can sell anything with anything. That is the voraciousness of capital. But apparently, the lesbian and the lesbian alone can sell nothing. Right? And so my point here is not to say, oh, the poor lesbians, we have to make the lesbians also lovely and bring them onto Showtime, and, oh, look, the L Word did such a good job of depicting lesbians as also successful. Hell no. There's something amazing about the fact that you cannot sell stuff through a lesbian, okay? So think of Martina Navratilova, the world's greatest women's tennis player ever, ever. Her only endorsements in her whole career was the damn rainbow Visa card, you know, which, who has a rainbow Visa card? Like, no one, right? And the Subaru, which is another symbol of failing, by the way. So I'm interested here in just, in actually, you know, keeping the lesbian tethered to losing. Because again, if you want to bring together the queer and the critique of capital, there's something stubbornly resistant in the image of the lesbian. Really, we're talking about the butch lesbian that resists the male gaze of capital or resists whatever it is that capital tends to do to just about everything to make it marketable. But here we have, you know, Amélie Mauresmo and Martina Navratilova, and I'm sure you can come up with others. You know, Rosie O'Donnell doesn't do a lot of endorsements. Ellen does, but it's always a little weird with the MAC makeup, and you don't believe it, you know, in so many ways. So being a lesbian is a surefire way to fail. Again, we should hold on to this connection of being an obstacle to capital, because we've lived in an age where apparently nothing is an obstacle to capital. So here we have one little lonely beacon in the marketplace. Okay. All right. This is the cover of the book, and I got the image from an LA artist, Judy Bamba. This is, first of all, you have to understand, the rule, think small, okay? If you want to go with failure, don't think big, don't have grand ambitions, don't have a big plan to change the world. Think small, really, really, really tiny, miniature. And that's how political change happens, when you give up on losing and you go to failure. And there are all kinds of political projects that are built around thinking small. The Situationists, in many ways, were all about just doing these very small interventions that just gave one little turn of the screw and changed everything. You know, so I love this painting, though, because first of all, it's a huge canvas, and it draws you in simply by the vastness of this green canvas. And you see, at a distance, a tiny, exquisite object in its center. So the painting draws you in. You get closer, closer, closer. And as you lean in, ready to be charmed and ready to feel something about this little, tiny, exquisite object, it slaps you in the face. It's a dead baby bird. It looks like if somebody asked me if it was a chewed-up piece of toffee. Someone else asked me if it was a fetus. You know, there's something sort of disgusting about it. And the reason that I think this is such a powerful painting is because it refuses the sentimentality that usually is linked to the small and gives us access, therefore, to another range of affects that are associated with smallness and with sort of incremental change, if you like. She has a whole series of paintings that are these miniatures, and there's another one that's beautiful as well. It was between that one and this one, and it's a little shiny object. It looks almost like a bullet. You get close, it's a butt plug. So the miniature that sucks you in with the size and then spits you back out again with the what the actual object is. But in my book, the reason that the small is such a great panoply for me is because I make a big deal about children's animations in the book. And I suggest that children's animation, particularly 3D animation, this new wave of pixel animations, are absolutely inundated with narratives about failing. Because childhood is the last acceptable time, in a way, to fail. If you hold a child to impossible standards of success, you just end up with a very neurotic creature very, very quickly. So they have to be able to bumble, stumble, fail, and be complete losers. And then there are whole narratives in these cartoons that are crafted around losing. You know, think of Finding Nemo with his little bum fin. You know, the opening is that the whole fish family is decimated by a hungry shark. You know, and then we go on down from there, really. He gets lost, but he's a little disabled figure. And Finding Nemo means that first Nemo has to be lost, so that children are encouraged to think about themselves as fallible and to understand that then adulthood promises success. Okay, and this is part of the problem of adulthood, is that you're now pressured to be successful, having come out of the avenue of failure. And I'll get back to children's animation in a moment. Okay, but rule number four, you can see we're moving quickly through this. We're already on rule number four of failure. No more heroes. One of, you'll remember that Stranglers song, I'm sure a few people here from, I guess it was from like 1977, No More Heroes, and they have a lyric, "Whatever happened to Leo Trotsky? He got an ice pick, it made his ears burn." And in 1977, that I loved that song. That was like my anthem, No More Heroes. And I kind of wanted to bring that sensibility to queer studies, and this is, it's not exactly an academic argument, but it's more a comment about the way that in academia we build a lot of our narratives around heroic figures of gay, lesbian, transgender people, ignoring the fact that gay, lesbian, and transgender people have also at different times participated in aberrant political projects. Of course they have. We're a very weird, diverse community. But we only focus on the heroic narratives. And this is therefore, it's a kind of epistemological problem, it's a philosophical problem, and so on. And so I use the work of Collier Shaw, who's a New York based photographer, to think about that old connection between homosexuality and fascism. And of course, the standard line to take is, oh, no, there was no connection between homosexuality and fascism. This is just part of the lineage of homophobia. But actually, there were a lot of connections, a lot of really weird connections that it seemed to me were worth fleshing out in order to produce a different understanding of what it means to be gay, lesbian, and to get rid of these heroic, redemptive narratives within which gays, lesbians, transgender people never fail. And I'll let you explore that chapter on your own, but you can ask me about it if you're interested. Okay, but then there are a couple of other ways in which I try to deflate the category of the heroic. And one way really dovetails with Maggie's work, actually, and she has some absolutely beautiful readings in that book of 1970s performance art by people like Marina Abramović and Yoko Ono. And for me, that's an archive that I use too, in order to say that there are these very anti-heroic feminisms that we also sort of gloss over in our desire to tell stories about women becoming something, doing something, being something. We ignore this whole amazing archive of performance art by women in the 1970s. It was not about being and was not about doing, but was about sitting on a stage and slowly coming undone. Okay, and a best example would be the Yoko Ono piece that both Maggie and I discuss, Cut Piece, where she literally gives the audience a pair of scissors and allows them to basically cut her clothing off her. And Marina Abramović has made an entire career out of these kinds of performances. In a way, the question that those performances ask us is, what is that feminism that is built out of something like masochism or unbecoming or not being, right? What is that feminism that wants to completely destroy the category of woman rather than inhabit it? And that feminism can be found in a number of different places. So just to close piece number four, here's one other place that it can be found, okay? You'll remember in your many viewings of Chicken Run, is that there are a couple of different feminist options in Chicken Run. And for anyone who doesn't think Chicken Run is feminist, you know, go back, watch it again. Chickens are all female. They're rising up against the farmers. You remember the farmers have their mode of production depends upon eggs. And then they decide that the chickens no longer are going to be the laborers. They are going to be the product. They're going to be the chicken pot pie. It's a Gramscian fable about organic chicken intellectuals who rise up, literally, and are going to fly from the coop. But there are three main figures in the film, and there's one that's the obvious feminist, Ginger, who's like, you know, Miss Go-Getter. Okay, she gets associated with Mel Gibson, which should already be a clue. Don't follow this one. And then there's Bunty, who is the hard-nosed cynic, who doesn't want anything, who no plan is good enough. She's a naysayer. But then there's Babs. And so Babs is my choice for the feminist who's all about failure in a way. So at one point, Ginger says, we're going to die free or die trying. Beautiful sentiment, you know, you're ready to stand up, follow her wherever she wants to go. And then Babs says, are those the only options? That's the kind of feminist that one wants to be, okay? The one, the weird little one in the corner who's doing the knitting, saying, well, I don't know, is that it, right? Death or freedom? Surely there's something else, all right. All right, so we're at number five, and we'll get to the penis, luckily. Number five is don't be successful, just be fantastic. Okay. So, as I said, the archive of animation runs through the whole book. And just as I was finishing the book, I saw this wondrous marvel of animation, stop-motion animation, Fantastic Mr. Fox by Wes Anderson. And there are so many parables in here about masculinity, failed masculinity, that, you know, we could speak the whole evening about them. But one of the best symbols for a version of masculinity that basically is able to reconcile itself to a certain form of failure is that when Mr. Fox goes off to go back to stealing chickens from the farmers and can't settle down in his little burrow, goes off to steal chickens, one of the farmers chops his tail off and wears it as a tie, which is such a, you know, these are all sort of symbols of masculine competition. But the amazing Mr. Fox is not that put out by losing his tail, even though this seems like a kind of, you know, phallic dispossession. He gamely goes on. Now, he has two sons, a sissy and a yoga expert, okay? So the drama of masculinity continues to play itself out. And finally, the sissy son, in the course of many, you know, meetings, staged meetings with the farmers, the sissy son manages to steal the tail back, and he brings it home. And Mr. Fox is so delighted to get the tail back, not because he can now be re-phallicized, but because he loves the idea of having a detachable tail. Okay, it's a dildo, basically, right? It goes on, it goes off, goes on, goes off. And he's like, I can get it dry cleaned, I can wash it. But the real source of pleasure for him is that being able to take the phallus on and off, he says, relieves him of the burden of always having to be fantastic. Okay, so it's that phallic burden that I would offer to men who are wondering why they should want to fail that is a path to male failure. So in conclusion then, the queer art of failure, as I've shown in my 10 minutes, is a kind of anti-heroic archive that records, in a way, a history of pessimism and tries to make nice with it. To cling to failure, I can't really read this now. I shouldn't try to read because I don't have my glasses. But to cling to failure and limits and loss is not to give up on hope or futurity, but it is part of recognizing that those kinds of buoyant affects have been crafted for winners everywhere, and that there's a darker archive to which we should reconcile that is in a critical relationship to happiness, to profit, to the market, and that invents, by the way, new forms of value, new measures for success and failure, and a quiet recognition that happily all good things must come to an end. Thank you.
I have a mic for anybody who would like to ask a question.
Hi. This was so wonderful in every way. I have a question for Jack. Jack.
Yes.
Why is only the butch lesbian the obstacle to capital? Just because I've been spending my life as a feminine lesbian trying to be an obstacle to capital. I mean, I've been finding lipstick on the street to use as opposed to buying it. So talk to me about why you said that.
Is that a hostile question? Is failure, why is it the butch lesbian, can't the femme be a failure too, is what I take you to be asking. Yes and no. I don't make these rules. I mean, I made these rules, but capital runs nicely through feminine bodies, and in fact a lot of heteropornography loves, and who doesn't love two feminine bodies together, and that's the problem, is that there's a way in which the feminine lesbian body has already been grabbed by a certain form of capitalist pleasure, right, or a certain form of visual pleasure that means that she can't be the block. She's not a cock blocker, you know? The butch literally stills male desire, and therefore you can't use her to sell things. That's all I mean. And I'm not trying to make her, therefore, into a hero. It's more just like, isn't that interesting that we thought capital could meet no obstacle without overcoming it, but the butch lesbian is one of those things, is one of those immovable objects.
So you're thinking fixed visual image.
I'm thinking visual image. I'm not talking about people. Because, of course, butches are all kinds of ways, pots of capital and so on. I'm thinking the visual image. Like, you can show two women mud wrestling and sell beer with that, right? No problem. I've seen that commercial. Two butches mud wrestling? That's not going to sell the beer.
Hi, thank you all. That was fantastic. I wonder if any of the three of you have anything to say about, in relation to cruelty or humiliation or failure, about the Occupy Wall Street protests, or, I mean, here and around, I guess, the States.
Offhand, I don't see something too immediate about humiliation, except that I'm sure that any ripple in... any ripple in world or local affairs will cause stomach upset and dyspepsia, and I mean, we are anxious creatures, and potentially humiliated creatures. So that I think that change is humiliating. Stasis is also humiliating. So that's a bland answer, but almost anywhere you look at it, you will find some grain of humiliation in that episode. I think, I mean, obviously, I had a conversation with some of the people there, and they seemed pretty humiliated, and I was humiliated by my conversation with them, and I mean, there's just humiliation everywhere, but I think that it's Jack, that seems very attuned to this, I am an anarchist, and I'm thrilled to hear anarchy receive its manifesto tonight.
Yeah, exactly, and so just to say that people are looking for new forms of political protest, they are, and precisely because failure brings you to that place where you absolutely have to do something different, something drastic. And so I love that people are trying to think about different ways to be riotous. And I like holding on to the idea of riot rather than replacing it with something proper and formal like insurrection. Riot really suggests disorder and running rampage and not rebuilding a new order, but actually reveling in the disorder. And so that Occupy Wall Street seems to me to have some of that flavor of revelry.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add on the cruelty account to that, but since I'm stepping out of my cruelty spokesperson mode, what's that?
Pepper spray.
No, true enough. Yeah, no, I was just going to say that I think that, though, if you... I wish I could recall the op-ed yesterday in the Times, but it said something like at the end, you know, boy, we sure hope this pillow fight turns into a, I don't know what the phrase was, but, you know, I would just be very attuned to the diminutive, humiliating phrases that the press uses, you know, calling, you know, that anything grungy kids with, you know, hacky sacks and delivered pizzas do as, you know, inherently, you know, a pillow fight, you know, irrelevant, stupid. And I think Jack's point about embracing all that kind of for the first time and also, you know, not being ashamed of the lack of demand, you know, of the grunginess, you know, of all of that, and you know, who maybe pillow fight is what we, you know, not eventually need to have, but just to be very aware of the press's attempts to impress this humiliating failure, you know, is a form of cruelty on what's going on down there. So.
So my question is for Jack. You seemed very certain when you said that, you know, we've kind of this crisis of capitalism is the final crisis or is some sort of different crisis. And we don't need to talk at length about whether, you know, this is particularly different than all the other crises. But I am interested in kind of the historical dimension of failure and where, I mean, you mentioned the situationist, but where failure itself as opposed to just this kind of small strategy of like small changes, but specifically failure may have been an element of kind of political action historically in the face of similar crises.
Yeah, okay, it's Josh, is it? Yeah. That's such a good question and such a big question, and that I was trying to sidestep it a little bit by saying let's look at the incremental, because of course an essential part of Marxism is that the system must collapse under its own weight, and when it does, that then is the moment that the workers can rise up and so on. But the problem is that leaves one grand scheme fails to make way for the next. And so if you read, like, Zizek has one of, you know, book number 75, I think, was In Defense of Lost Causes. And I thought, oh, great, Zizek's writing about failure. And, of course, it wasn't. It was really about replacing one grand narrative with another. So I'm trying not to replace one grand narrative with another, but to recognize what supposedly we were all saying in relation to postmodernism, that when the grand narrative splinters, you get a lot of little narratives that you should now pay attention to as little narratives. Like that desire for the grand narrative has to go the way of failure. And I do think it's in anarchism that you find this willingness to accommodate smaller, the local, the sense of possibility that is crafted between people as opposed to a relationship between people and the state where there's going to be a grand scheme coming down the pipe. So James Scott is one person I would point to, but my book has a number of different people who I think are participating in a new form of anarchism. And there's this great book by Dave Graeber that actually Maggie gave me called Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology that does some of that work too. Thanks.
Now, just a quick question about failure as a as a structure somehow, and humiliation as an affect. Mm-hmm. So, failure is some kind of situation in which there's a standard and you don't meet it, and then humiliation a feeling. And it seems to me like humiliation could well be the affective content of failure that would best secure it from being success. But I wonder if there are other affective possibilities in failure, what they are, and how you keep them from being secretly successful.
Yeah. What do you think, Wayne, in your book, humiliation is a sort of landscape of feeling that one has to inhabit, and but you're not pulling something from it in order to redeem yourself, right?
And I also think failure can involve a quiet sense of equipoise. I think Robert Valser, I quote this in my book, Robert Valser speaks of the bliss of being small, the satisfaction, finding in smallness and failure a kind of repose and even a kind of home. That's not humiliation. That's the experience of smallness, maybe the grandiose experience it as humiliating, but that it's actually a kind of blankness, repose. I call it in my book the consolation of aftermath. So, and I even think that, you know, that after humiliation can be kind of paradoxically relaxing. So I don't think I don't think that. So I think, for example, was it a chicken knitting? I don't know that show. There was like a chicken. Yeah, I don't know. Sorry, but the knitting that scene. But I love the notion of sitting on the side of majority culture, merely knitting and quibbling, mm-hmm. and I don't think that the affect there would be humiliation. I think it would be keen insight, mm-hmm. Observational acumen.
Right, yeah. Right. But also, you know, what I love about this idea of humiliation is that. One sense of humiliation is that you experience it and then you have to overcome it and then you have to rebuild. But I feel like in Wayne's book, he's willing to, using his own experience as the archive, to come undone. And that's a lot of what these different affective projects are about, is being willing to come undone, as opposed to this project of self-building that is akin to nation-building, that is akin to profit-building and so on, that... a very important part of being human is the coming undone part that we might even call queer, as opposed to trying to rescue the queer and pull it back for a better project, a redemptive or a heroic project. Eileen.
One is sort of a comment, because I couldn't help thinking about the Wall Street thing and thinking that it really actually totally backs up what Jack is saying, because the thing is, every time the mass media encounters or comments on or deigns to admit that it's happening, they keep saying it's incoherent. It's incoherent. There's no single message. It's sort of like it's this giant lesbian or something. Like they can't spin it, you know. I think the idea that there's no way that it can be sent through the world as a wonderful message of what's going on in America, and it's actually an incredibly incoherent message of what exactly is going on in America, and the failure, they're showing it as a failure, and in their terms it absolutely is that, which is the utter beauty of it, you know, to go down there,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
And I just thought about Wayne's, and it's sort of a question, but it's sort of the wrong question in a way, because that was so tormented by that one first pimply asked boy, that was a torture spectacle. You know, that just seemed like somebody who was receiving the most horrible cruelty, and it was more cruel because he was like the bird. It was so, even though we had his name, it seemed anonymous in a way, because sitting here, we were like, wonder what happened to him. You know, is he dead? Is he, you know, that was clearly his trauma moment. And I wondered if you had any inclination, so this is the wrong question, ever hear any gossip? Do you know what happened to that kid?
It's interesting. I mean, it's so funny because I make a big point in whenever I talk about my book to couch it in notions of high style and form and literary, and so now here I am talking about what really happened, you know, so it's, but I'm capable of that as well. I would say, one thing I don't mention about that scene that I actually think is the most fascinating thing is that those who watched the torture were the advanced readers. And that the boy who was punished was a not advanced reader who was kept late. The slow readers left for the day, and then there was like an hour. So that in a way I feel that my book is very linguistically self-conscious or conscious of language as the arena of humiliation, and that it was somehow in that scene that it was slow reading. That was the slow reader was being tortured, and the quick readers, the verbally precocious, were... the were the viewers. But in terms of gossip or anything, no, I don't. I've often wondered since I've written about this scene ad infinitum, and it sort of is my Madeleine, you know, or like it or not. So I often wondered, were those other, like, tan, you know, the Mormon girl that I hit over the head with a chair, what did she think? We never had a support group to discuss it. I suppose maybe there's a Facebook. I could start a Facebook page. I don't mean to make light of the question, but it you know.
How did you accidentally hit her over the head with a chair?
Well, I saw one of those chairs the other day, and they're actually really, really, really tiny. So the damage. How did I? I was a very exuberant child who got zeros in self-control, and I was probably. I was fourth, and I was trying to be number one, and I was just, you know, like a lasso, the chair above my head.
I'm interested also in, Jack, and how failure is often used as a cover for fraud and abuse and exploitation. Basically, we, you know, within Wall Street, let's just take the subprime mortgage market, the boom and bust, taking companies, you know, blowing them up into huge successes and then running them into bankruptcy. And, of course, the founders make lots of money before they go into bankruptcy. And this has been a cycle that was actually repeated over and over again. And, of course, everyone acted surprised when it happened in 2007, 2008. But in the business world and the financial system, failure is really a tool to take advantage.
Yeah, well, yeah. Oh, that's right. That's right. The leveraging of companies that you've taken insurance on them. And, I mean, actually, insurance requires that there be failure and success as well, but not in equal measures and so on. I mean, I think what in a way, the punchline here that I'm trying to get at in relationship to capital is that the fantasy of capital is that anyone can be a winner. But the reality is that most people will be a loser. It's like when you go to Vegas, the fantasy is that you'll win, you'll be the winner. But at what point, I mean, this is almost, you know, going back to the political question, at what point do people then recognize that capitalism is great for 5% of the population, and then for everyone else, it's a losing strategy. So, of course, it can be a cover, but that's already within the structure where you have insurance companies and multiply mediated entities that know that things will fail. It's just the consumer who seems to be in the dark about failure. So,
I was told that the event has to end at 9 o'clock.
We've got to drag it on for.
So I think it's since it's 9 o'clock.
Yeah, we can go on a little later.
We can go on a little later. Great. Is there more questions or just
please
comments?
Please join me in thanking Wayne, okay. Maggie, and Jack.